decided to join me for this episode of British Accents on the Preacher's Forum podcast. In today's episode, I'm going to bring you the first half of an interview that I did with a good friend of mine, Mr. Keith Rycroft from Chester, England. He comes out of what he calls the quote-unquote non-theistic Quaker tradition. Now, what in the world is that? Well, you're going to have to stay tuned to find out what it's all about. Now, first, though, before I bring you that conversation that I had with Keith, we've got a little business to conduct. Now, if you want to get a hold of me, there's a variety of ways that you can do that. You can send me your questions, comments, ideas for future show topics, or just say hi. Okay, you can follow me on social media, Twitter, at Preacher's Forum. I'm also Preacher's Forum on Instagram as well. You can always send me an email, preachersforum@gmail.com, or stop by my Facebook page. Please like it and join in the conversation, facebook.com/thepreachersforum. Also, if you're listening to this podcast, if you're on iTunes or Podbeans, I've got one last request for you. Please rate and review the show, which will definitely help with our visibility. Okay, now before we get into the conversation with myself and Keith, I wanted to talk about a couple things first by way of introduction. It's always good, I think, to understand, at least as much as it's possible anyway, your own context. You know, there's a lot of questions we have. You know, where did you come from? Where were you born? What sort of family were you born into? And of course, we have to talk about religion. You know, what have been your religious experiences personally, you know, growing up? Or maybe you had none at all. If you grew up in a particular church, for example, like I did, there's a whole lot of questions that we've got to ask. Now, if you listen to my last two podcasts, which were the first two ones that I did in my new series that's called British Accents, what I've been talking about is making the point that perhaps the view of God that you currently have or that you had, quite often you inherited that view from somebody else. And I'm asking, on this basis, can you question and possibly revise that view of God? I think it's very freeing, actually, when you realize that perhaps, you know, my view of God, I didn't necessarily formulate it on my own. It was taught to me. And actually, that gives you the emotional space to be able to step back and say, you know what? Maybe I need to question. Maybe I do need to revise that view of God. Maybe that view of God is incomplete or flawed or faulty. And maybe you were raised in a particular church, maybe a particular religious tradition. Perhaps you were raised as an atheist or an agnostic. What I want to say is, okay, however your upbringing came about, there's a long story behind where that movement or that denomination, that faith tradition that you were raised in came from historically. Okay, what am I talking about? Well, let me explain. Okay, take my story, for example. Like many of you, I was raised from literally the minute I was born, I was in church. My parents were heavily involved. My dad was an elder. He was the worship leader. You know, this denomination, they were called the Church of Christ, okay? They had some really interesting denominational practices and beliefs. For one thing, the church I was raised in, they taught that in order to be saved, that is, for a person to become a Christian, what you needed to do was to be baptized, okay? That was it. Now, there's a fancy theological description for this belief. It's called baptismal regeneration. In other words, what they taught was the act of baptism itself, when you're dunked, you know, down in the water and you come back up, that actually regenerates or it saves the person being baptized. So let's go back to when I was about 10 or so. All of my friends, my buddies were getting baptized and I didn't want to be left out. So I went to the pastor and I said, "Hey, I want to be a Christian too, Pastor." And his response was, "Great, let's get you baptized." And so I did. That is, for the first time anyway. But in reality, all that happened to me was I just took a dip in a little pool. I got wet. Nothing changed except for the fact that now I thought I was a Christian, but I wasn't. So I lived for the next 3 years or so. I was on an emotional and spiritual roller coaster. What I was trying to do was I was trying to live the Christian life in my own power, you know, under my own steam. And there was a lot of talk. I can remember this really clearly. Every summer I'd go to these Christian summer camps with my friends. And these camp speakers, they'd hype you all up, you know, and you'd be sitting around the campfire at night. And they'd be talking stuff like, you know, you need to put the Lord Jesus on the throne of your heart and, you know, stuff like that. Man, I tried to put Jesus on that throne. I tried to live a life that I thought was dedicated to Him. But in the end, I would always end up miserably failing. So when I was 13, about 3 years after I'd been baptized, I was totally fed up with being a complete failure. Well, by this time, we had a new pastor at our church. And I went to him and I confessed. You know, I said, look, I'm a miserable failure as a Christian. I'm pretty sure I'm not even saved at all. And you know what his response was? He said to me, well, maybe the first baptism didn't take. Perhaps it wasn't done right. Let's get you baptized again. And so I did, for the second time. But you know what? The second baptism didn't take either. And the next few years went by pretty much the same way they'd done after my first baptism when I was 10. I mean, I tried to live the Christian life in my own power, under my own steam, and yet again ended up as a miserable failure. And my view of God during those years, I can remember this, He was always pretty much disappointed. He was angry with me. I mean, I was a clear-cut loser. I was a failure. So by the time I hit about 16, 17, you know what? I just decided that, look, if anybody asked me, are you a Christian? I was just going to say no. I just gave up trying to live the Christian life. I just couldn't seem to put Jesus on the throne of my heart. You know, I couldn't seem to make Him, in the words of those camp speakers. They'd always say stuff like, you need to make Jesus both the Lord and the Savior of your life. And so it went for the next several years. In my early 20s, though, I did end up coming back to church a few years later. In 1988, I did become a Christian. I was at a church service. A friend of mine dragged me to one Sunday evening. But then the nagging question surfaced. Now, should I get baptized again? Considering I'd failed miserably twice, the first two baptisms didn't take, I was pretty sure God was probably still disappointed with me. Those first two baptisms, like I said, didn't take, so I resisted for years. And here's the ultimate irony. It wasn't until I actually started attending Bible college, I'd become a youth pastor, I was working in church ministry, I finally decided to get that third, and thankfully final, baptism. So why am I telling you all this background information? Well, I'm trying to illustrate the point that our theology, our views of God, the way we read the Bible and more, are oftentimes inherited from somebody else. In other words, there's a backstory there. Now, have you ever heard of a little town in Great Britain? It's called Keswick. Probably never heard of it. Well, back in the 19th century, back in the Victorian era, in Great Britain, there was what they called a holiness movement. There were a lot of Brits. They were fed up with how stale and cold the orthodoxy of the Church of England had become. They started taking the train up to what's called the Lake District in the north of England, and that's where the town of Keswick is located. And basically, they had a summer camp in this little town called Keswick, which, by the way, is a beautiful place if you ever get a chance to visit. But the resulting teaching and the theology that came out of this holiness movement in Victorian England in the 19th century eventually made its way across the pond to the United States. Now, some of the beliefs, some of the practices that came out of this Keswick theology or holiness movement eventually filtered into the Church of Christ denomination. And this is where we get this teaching of, you know, putting Jesus on the throne of your heart and making Jesus both the Lord and the Savior of your life and so forth, you know, as if you could anyway. So What I'm saying is more than 150 years before I was even born, this holiness movement in the north of England, in the Lake District, had a direct impact on my life. I mean, I'd never even heard of Keswick theology. I didn't even have a clue about it. In fact, I only heard about it when I was in seminary. The professor started talking about it one day. He was talking about Keswick theology, and I had this major aha moment. I discovered that these teachings were the root of the theology that I'd grown up hearing. So what I'm saying is, understanding the context of what we think we believe, in other words, is massively important. We are, after all, products of our environment, whatever that environment may be. Now, in this episode of British Accents, as I said before, I'm going to have a conversation with a good friend of mine, Keith Rycroft. Now, I'm going to let him tell you his story, but basically, he represents the Quaker tradition. Now, what's that all about? Well, here's yet another example of how a movement that took place a long time ago, it's still very much alive today, it's influenced people all over the world. I mean, imagine, okay, you're back in the 17th century, the late 1600s, growing up during the English Civil War. Now, like any civil war, the country was quite literally torn apart by all kinds of divisions. You had family fighting against family, friend against friend, religion against religion. I mean, it was a time of major upheaval. Okay, we're talking politically, religiously, economically, and so on. Well, by the time the whole English Civil War ended, the armies of Parliament, they've won the war under the leadership of Oliver Cromwell. He was a staunch Puritan. Okay, they ended up beheading the losing king, Charles I, and Cromwell then took over the country. So this then is the time period that a young man named George Fox, he had grown up during the conflict, the English Civil War, he'd seen some of the battles and so on. He went out all over the country. He was preaching and teaching a really radical message. I mean, imagine how radical this was. In the late 17th century, George Fox taught anybody could read the Bible for themselves, that a genuine conversion experience, that was something that you needed. He said, look, the Holy Spirit is what gives a person the qualifications for being a minister. I mean, that meant that men, women, and children even could teach each other. I mean, that's a radical concept even today. Now, he taught that God lives in the heart of a converted person. He's not confined to a physical building. So a lot of times, the Quakers had services outdoors even. So it doesn't take a lot of imagination to understand that, you know, his teachings didn't exactly meet with a lot of approval by the religious establishment of the day. He was thrown in prison more than a few times for his beliefs, but he refused to stop. So out of this movement then comes what's called the Quakers, or the Religious Society of Friends. You have people like William Penn. He's a friend of George Fox. He goes on to found the colony of Pennsylvania in America. And that explains, by the way, why Pennsylvania is called the Quaker State, in case you didn't know that. Fox even came across the pond. He taught in America. He later on traveled to the Netherlands. He traveled to Germany in the late 1600s. And he ended up dying in London in 1691. But the movement that he and others helped to found, it's carried on even to this day all over the world. So this is an incredible legacy that George Fox and other Quakers helped to start way back in the 17th century. So this is something that Keith Rycroft is a part of. And as you'll hear in the interview, my family, that's on my father's side, they were also a part of this movement way back in the late 17th century. They knew William Penn, for example, personally. It's funny because some of them even settled in Chester, Pennsylvania in 1711. And basically that's where virtually every Haycock in Canada and America comes from, which is, I think, interesting. Okay, enough of that history. Let's get on with part one of my conversation with Keith Rycroft, a non-theistic Quaker. Hey everybody, this is Dr. Clint Haycock. I am sitting here in a beautiful conservatory with a good friend of mine, Keith Rycroft.
Hello.
This is Keith. We've known each other, well, not, I wouldn't say we knew each other super close. I've done work for Keith.
Yeah, yeah.
Off and on. Mm. Because I used to live, we're in beautiful Chester. We're
ooh,
in a suburb called Hanbridge,
uh-huh.
which my wife and I, we lived in Hanbridge for about 8 years. And that's kind of how we met,
yes,
wasn't it?
Yeah,
through
really.
Some local connections.
Yeah.
I did some work for Keith. And then we found, as we talked, that... Keith represented sort of a Quaker friends tradition.
Yeah.
And as we'll talk about more in a minute, that my family from England, Staffordshire area, they were Quakers in the 17th century.
Yeah.
So we're interested to talk about a little bit of the history of Quakerism and things like that.
Well, I'm part of that tradition. I wouldn't say I represented it, but I don't
yes,
say that.
You were saying that you're not... What would you describe yourself as? You're not a quote-unquote Quaker per se?
I am a Quaker.
You are
a
Quaker.
But I would... I hate to get into these long definitions. Someone once said to me ages ago, labels are sticky things. You know, and I think that's true. I mean, basically, I'm a Quaker, but I'm a non-theist within a Quaker setting.
Right.
But non-theism, and it's a very odd term. And why would you describe yourself as something that begins with a negative?
A non.
Which is not maybe the best thing, but we struggled and struggled and struggled to find something that worked, and we couldn't really find a decent alternative. So it's but I am basically... I suppose I'm an agnostic within a non-theistic tradition.
Yeah.
So that's a really strange one.
You've got quite a label. Is it before or after the name? I'm Keith and I'm this and this and this.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit difficult to say. I mean, I just prefer to say I'm Quaker. But you know, you'll find within Quakers that, you know, you'll get as many different opinions as there are Quakers.
Yeah. Well,
you
it's like a Christian
find.
Church.
Yeah.
Denominations galore represented millions of Christians all over the world.
And
so many stripes and variations.
Yeah. And there are people with my views within the Christian church and within different strands of whatever, you know, Unitarians and whatever.
And yeah, and this is why I'm really excited to do this British accent series, because it's a chance for me as an American living here in this country to sort of give voice to a lot of different traditions, faiths, atheists, agnostics, you name it, I'll talk to anybody. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm thinking if a lot of people are listening, let's say in a North American context, when they hear the word Quaker, I mean, what comes to my mind, Quaker Oats? You know,
now, that's a funny
Quaker
one.
Quaker State, Pennsylvania.
Now, Quaker Oats,
like that.
Quaker Oats, oddly, has got nothing to do with Quakers.
They just... co-opted the name.
Whoever invented Quaker Oats or whatever, or the company, I don't quite know how it worked, but apparently I think that in days gone by, in sort of 17th century such and so forth, Quakers, certainly in this country, and I think maybe in the New World, as we called it, in America.
The colonies,
yeah. But there was obviously a movement, because William Penn was a leading Quaker in those days, in the 17th century, 1600s.
Yeah.
And he went over to America with a number of Quakers, and because of the king... King Charles II at the time. It was the time of the Restoration. That's a history lesson now. Restoration. He said to William Penn, yes, you can go. I mean, because the king at that time, English people can do, sort of very sort of arrogantly thought, well, yes, well, we've discovered this place.
Yeah.
You know, and ignoring the fact that there are Native Americans there called American Indians or whatever at the time, and didn't think they were of much account. And so, well, yes, we'll claim it for the queen.
Yes.
Fly the flag. And yes, you can go there, William. So he did. But he said, the only condition I'm putting on it is that you must call it after you.
Yeah.
And so that became
Pennsylvania. Right.
And it is like...
Quaker State. That's the official name of Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
Although most people don't necessarily know the history.
No.
Now, even going back a bit further, the name that comes to my mind when associated with Quakers is George Fox.
Oh, yes.
You could say he was the founder. It's not just the Quaker, it's more the Society of Friends.
Yes, he's talked about it as the founder. He was certainly one of the main ones, but there were some very significant people around at the time or a bit later. There was people like John Woolman. I think John Woolman actually was an American Quaker. I may be wrong there, but he's the one who... in a what we call a yearly meeting, and that's a meeting right. that represents all the various Quaker meetings, and I'm pretty sure that was in America. And yeah. he was the one who came in very plain clothing, with no buttons, no dyed cloth. And this was his personal protest. He was a bit like he was a bit of an early protester, which is a bit yeah. of a thing with Quakers.
Well, this is it. Yeah, we need to get into that maybe later on.
Okay, yeah.
There's that's an about issue slavery, of pacifism, really. And there's yeah. a lot of sort of yeah. values, aren't yeah. there, that are
well, he was anti-slavery.
Yeah.
And he was saying that one human being cannot own another.
Yeah.
And after that yearly meeting, apparently, certainly in America, I think pretty much all and most Quakers who did have slaves, and I like to think treated them well, but yeah. said one human being can't own another friends. We call ourselves friends, you see.
Yeah, yeah.
And apparently most Quakers, if not all, then changed the status of their slaves into employees.
Right, right.
I mean, how that was in reality, I don't know. But I mean, but they took it on yeah. board. That's wrong.
Because it was certainly the context of the day. It was a more of a normal thing.
It was just
thing.
Normal.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think you mentioned the Restoration. I mean, for people yeah. not necessarily familiar with English or British history,
oh, right. yeah.
this is the period after yeah. the English Civil War.
That's right.
When George. King Charles I
that's him.
Fought against, basically, Parliament, yeah. which was largely represented by yeah. Puritans, weren't they?
Yeah, well, he lost his head, really, over
yeah.
sadly. Well, I mean,
he,
I mean,
he, he lost the war and yeah. lost his head. King Oliver Cromwell became the
yes,
Lord Protector.
Lord Protector.
Once Oliver Cromwell died, this is what Keith is talking about, King Charles II, who was King Charles I's son.
He was.
I think he was in exile in
yeah,
France
in
at
France,
the time.
Yeah, yeah.
He was restored to the throne,
yeah,
as it
was.
Were, so
yeah.
they put him on the throne.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of Quakers were being persecuted because this is a time of religious dissension. They were dissenters,
oh,
is
yes,
what they were called.
Yes, yes.
And I know, I've discovered in my own family history, in the 17th century, some of my relatives were put
yeah.
in prison
oh, yes.
for not paying tithes to the state.
To the church as well.
Yeah, actually. And it was the state would put you in prison if you
yes.
didn't pay your tithes to the church.
Seriously.
So we talk about there's no separation of church and state, which is
no.
very different than the American experience.
Yes,
isn't it?
Well, that's why Quakers wanted to go. That was kind of kicked off the thing, really, why... you know, a lot of Quakers wanted to go to what was called a New World, which obviously became
yeah.
America, and then yeah, Pennsylvania, etc. And they went to other places as well.
Yeah, there's Quakers in Australia and
oh,
all around.
Oh, over this
yeah.
place. But, and in Africa and all over the place.
Yeah.
But it was, it really, the 17th century England, we'll call it, it wasn't Britain then,
yeah, yeah.
Was a very different place. It was a very oppressive place. I mean, we look around the world today and we think, ooh, that's an oppressive country. And we might look at the Middle East, believe you me, this country was no different
yeah.
in the 17th century.
Yeah.
I mean, it was almost like being ruled by the Taliban.
Yeah.
And, I mean, dress codes,
yeah,
you know, not
yeah.
going to church, you could be fined or put in prison. You know, this kind of thing. I mean, not maybe an exact parallel with the Taliban, but very extreme
yeah.
puritanical religious views.
This is it, yeah,
yeah,
because when Cromwell became the Lord Protector, wasn't it, the Puritans put a lot of very harsh rules in place.
Oh,
they tried to ban theaters.
Oh, they did.
they did. They banned a lot of things. That
singing,
we would,
dancing.
Yeah,
oh,
fun
yeah.
experiences,
fun.
Drinking.
Oh, good Lord.
Very
Lord.
Sort of a moral reform of
yeah.
the nation from
yeah.
a religious / political. And if
yeah.
you were, if you stepped out of line, they could,
yeah.
they would come down on
oh,
you.
Oh, absolutely.
You know,
absolutely.
And as I say, one of my relatives yeah. in the Staffordshire area was put in prison for 6 years. For not paying his tithes.
Yes,
and,
that was very common.
Yeah, and then when King Charles II was restored to the throne, he freed him, and he was out. He got out of prison. And like you say, a lot of people, including my relatives, the Haycock family comes from Staffordshire. They went to Pennsylvania, Chester, Pennsylvania. This is ironic because we lived in Chester, England. We came
right,
from
that.
America to
yeah.
come to Chester, but
yeah.
they went to Chester, Pennsylvania. And
yeah.
all the Haycock family in North America and Canada comes from that couple were fleeing for religious freedom.
Yeah, well, isn't it interesting? Coming back to your roots in a way.
yeah.
But the thing is,
yeah.
the other thing is, in the tower, there's a tower. Chester is a walled city. There's not very many of them. I think the only other one is York in Britain.
We're the only one that has the complete medieval Roman walls that go around it. Yeah.
And there's a tower on there called King Charles's Tower. Now, this is related to apparently King Charles I. In the time of the Civil War, he was holed up there. Yes. Well, he was actually locked up there.
His army lost a battle not far from Chester.
Routon Moor,
if you're into history... Chester originally was a Roman fort, and there's layers upon layers of history here. It's a beautiful place to visit.
Well, of course, the thing was, you see, the royalists, who were all very plumy hats and all very, you know, supported the king and what have you, and very flamboyant, I suppose, to look at, they had very good, army, and they were very practiced, because they were all gentry and used to riding horses and waving swords around.
They were the knights and
kind of thing. But the thing is, and they were winning, and they were really in the ascendancy, but Oliver Cromwell trained up something called the New Model Army.
Yeah.
And they hadn't quite encountered this before. And when they did, I think the tables turned.
Yeah, it was that first real disciplined army, army, wasn't it? So we've kind of touched a little bit on the sort of history of the Quakers. It's a time of political upheaval for sure.
Absolutely.
There'd just been a civil war. In fact, George Fox, he lived through the Civil War.
He did.
And he went all around the country preaching and sort of gathered a group of like-minded people, I guess you could say. But it was a dangerous time. He was put in prison. I think more than once, but I know once for sure. And so, you know, out of this comes the Quakers, the Society of Friends.
Yeah.
And there are certain values that resonate even today. Even they go back to that time.
Yeah.
You know, pacifism is one.
It's one that came out of the fact of the famous quote that I think it was to William Penn, actually. I think it was him. Mm. And because he obviously was contemporary with Penn. And William Penn, being a high-ranking person in the country, he was known to the king. This is King Charles II.
He had friends in high places.
Oh, he did have friends in the highest of places.
Yeah.
And he always wore a sword as part of his dress. And him and George Fox were walking one day, and he was a bit exercised about this. He says, George, he says, I don't know about wearing this sword. What do you think? And George Fox made the very famous remark, wear it until thou canst wear it no longer. Which is a very Quaker type sort of thing, you know. And because basically George Fox was convinced that the message then, which he saw as a very Christian message, and possibly is, saying that that the ways of war were not the way forward. You know, this was not a way to go. People needed peace, which he would say the peace of God or the peace of Christ.
Yeah.
People needed this, and this was a way to unite people, and this was a way, and this was the right thing to do.
Yeah,
you know, and really got into a lot of trouble for this.
Yeah, it's something that Quakers and Friends have been in trouble for in a way ever since. I mean, I'm a big fan of World War I history, and of course, this was the first time in British society where people actually refused to go to war on the basis of religious grounds, and a lot of them were Quakers. A lot of them, some were executed, were put in prison.
They were.
You know, but they stood up for their values. They stood up for what they believed in. Pacifism. I was thinking another famous value is, I guess you could say, the rights of women.
Yes.
Because George Fox, he held the novel idea that women had souls. What a concept.
Yes.
And women have been a part of the Quaker or Friends meetings, haven't they? Because
absolutely.
Can you describe for us sort of a Quaker, quote-unquote, church, not a church per se, but... It's you don't have a pastor or a...
Some do in America. Some do. Conservative friends sometimes do.
Yeah. Of course, in America, we have conservative.
Well, you know, America is a very different place and has all sorts of varieties. But in this country, we are basically the Britain Yearly Meeting, which is a non-program meeting. We don't have pastors, vicars, priests, imams, rabbis.
So there's no paid clergy.
There's no paid clergy, which is great in one level. At times you think, well, you know, might have been someone could take a decision on that. But Quakers famously, collectively take decisions. Quakers don't vote in their decisions. Vote in elections, but don't vote in their decisions, because the idea being is that we arrive at... at the we arrive at the feeling of the meeting, And now someone described as being guided by the spirit. People like me say, well, this is guided by conscience, imagination, thought, and rationality.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there's two divides there. You know, and that's fine. But sometimes if a decision can't be reached, the clerk, we have clerks who are not a position of power. They're just someone who kind of like helps the meeting, that meeting, yeah, to run.
Facilitates
a meeting, and we'll, yeah, say, yeah, friends, maybe we should lay this down. Which we'll is
come
a
back to it another
we'll come
time.
Back to it another time.
Just shelve it for now.
Yeah,
and,
for now. Yeah. And there will, when we, or sometimes the clerk might say, friends, we need a period of silence to reflect.
Yeah.
And then we might reflect for, I don't know, a certain period of time. And then sometimes we can come back, and when minds have cleared, you know, and then we can find a decision.
Yeah. Maybe in the heat of the moment, it's not a good time. And this is another sort of value of the Friends, yeah, and the Quakers, is, yeah, that this kind of the guiding light or the inner light
principle, inner light, yeah,
that you come together and just maybe sit in silence,
yeah,
for a good long period of time, until someone feels
usually
led or something.
About an hour overall for our meeting for,
yeah,
worship.
But it's a very contemplative.
Yeah.
It's very different from, let's say, the typical quote unquote church experience where,
yes,
it's very programmatic, isn't it? You come in,
yeah,
you've got greeters,
yeah,
you've got
yeah,
singing, and you've,
yeah,
got a sermon, and you've got various. Every church has those basic. Yeah. And paid clergy and paid staff,
yeah,
and a building,
yeah,
and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
And I think this is something that attracts people to Friends and Quakers, isn't it? Is the contemplative, the meditative,
yeah,
and it's very non-hierarchical.
Well, ideally it is. I,
yeah,
mean, there's always people who stick out and
there
will have a better view. That's just human nature. But I mean, no, the whole, and George Fox actually instituted this very early on. I mean, because when Quakers first started, and he was putting this idea, of course, that you didn't need priests or prelates or whatever, that, you know, that you could listen to the inner conscience,
yeah,
the inner spirit, you know, you could speak to, if you like, God directly.
Yeah. Which is a very radical idea,
oh,
really,
totally,
for its day and time.
Totally.
Even now, though.
Totally. Giving ordinary people, what?
Yeah.
Good looking,
yeah,
what?
I mean, I heard someone say, I think it's a good comment, about that time of the Reformation in Germany. Luther and all that, as well as the English Reformation, going back. It's another history lesson when Henry VIII broke from,
yes,
the Catholic Church. But it was sort of like opening Pandora's box.
Oh,
way,
yes.
Because once,
yes,
you've opened the ability for any person to read the Bible for themselves, and whatever that guiding spirit is that helps you interpret it and understand it and appropriate it, or however you want to say it, there's no longer any control.
Well,
and there's all these groups and sects that split and split,
that's
split,
right,
and split.
Quakers have managed to. I'm sure people did disappear off into different ways, but overall, there have been some major differences within the society. I mean, I think it's back in the 1920s. I can't quite remember the actual date, but there was a major conference. I think it was in Manchester. Maybe wrong about that. Or it might have been somewhere else. But then this was really a conference that spoke about this, you know, because Quakers at that time had considered themselves to be Christian.
Yeah.
And then other ideas, because there was new ideas about science and about, about sociology and
enlightenment,
all this kind of thing.
It's a big challenge,
yeah,
to the faith, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. And people said, well, you know, accepted the fact that, you know, that maybe the straightforward biblical Christian view, which I don't think Quakers really had a straightforward biblical,
yeah,
Christian view, in my own view.
Yeah.
But anyway, but that kind of area was, well, that could be expanded. People, you,
yeah,
know, we needed to incorporate some of the ideas of science and discovery that were sincerely,
ooh,
made. And that was
dangerous
a very,
thinking,
well, that's the way the danger comes in. And that's still the same today,
yeah,
in some sense. And you will still find, I'm sure, Quakers, you'll still find certain Quakers who are kind of okay with a certain, you know, where they are, and then, you know, like, for instance, I'm a member of the Non-Theist Friends Network.
Yeah.
Now that there is a bit of a documented history in our publication, The Friend, where a number of friends have been rather worried about that, because this is challenging the idea,
yeah,
or the existence of a God or,
yeah,
or a guiding spirit. And, you know, and some people are not very happy about that at all.
Yeah, you can't label yourself a Quaker or and be this or that.
Mm.
Now, that might be an interesting segue. I mean, you'd said we need to come back on this issue of your own kind of personal story. How do you end up? I can't remember all the the non-this and the labels,
it's
but
a strange story. Yeah.
What were you raised within the Quaker faith, or how did you come to this sort of place?
I was actually brought up. I was raised, as you say, by the Brethren. Now, this is different from the Brethren who are North American.
Plymouth Brethren.
Yeah, kind of idea. Yeah. Very different to the Brethren in America, who are very much seen as a peace church and one thing or another. I'm not saying we weren't unpeaceful, but we were very fundamentalist Christian, literalists, Bible-believing literalists.
Yes, I've met some. Yeah.
And that is... But as I call it a sect, you see, but then when you say sect, people go, oh, throw their hands up. But it wasn't a nasty place. Yeah. I mean, I had I'm an only child, but I had an extended family of uncles and aunts, and it was very warm upbringing. It was very, very, it was very pleasant. Yeah. I had lots of cousins and different things, and we all rubbed along as kids and played and whatever. And it was a very sort of warm, protective environment, and
nurturing
in a good way. Okay, we had the Bible and we had all these things that we had to believe. I mean, one funny story actually with this, I remember being quite young. My mother was always quite a reader, and she used to take me to the library when I was a kid. And of course, one of the things the Brethren believed in was the sort of imminent return of the Lord.
Oh, yes.
You see,
yes.
The second coming, the apocalypse and millennial belief. Yeah. And I remember we went to the library, and I don't quite know what you're thinking, really. She let me choose this book, Paul Alone in the World.
Ooh,
and I was reading this.
Dangerous.
Absolutely. And I was reading this book again. And I was thinking, oh. You know, and it kind of reminded me of these beliefs that I was aware of even as a young child. I remember sneaking along to my parents' bedroom to see if they were still there in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
You know,
have you been raptured?
Yeah, been raptured and taken away to the heavens, you know. But that was just one incident. But I mean, that's the sort of thing you can come up against.
Yeah.
And
I know. I have a similar story in my... Yeah. It was the Thief in the Night movie. I don't know if they ever got showed here in Britain, but that scared me to death when I was a kid. Oh. I was always afraid that everyone was going to get raptured and I'd be left behind. Yeah. And, you know, so you're raised in a climate of fear in a sense. But so you were raised sort of in this Brethren. It's a warm, nurturing family.
It was kind of this
sort of fundamentalist, biblical literalist.
Yeah, absolutely.
So how did you come out of that and get into...
I'd been involved in music for a long time, and strangely enough, we'd managed to sort of... I was playing guitar with my cousin and then a friend, and we got ourselves together with a young man who was older than us with a bit more vision.
Uh-huh.
A chap called Ian Sparks. He's dead now, sadly. I'm sure he'd be greatly missed. And he had a bit more vision, and he said, we'll go round to different places and we'll sing songs and whatever. And we did. And it was in a Christian context, but at the time I started to write lots of songs. Now, it was okay when I was singing songs about Jesus and all that. That was fine. But when I started singing songs that were more reflective and questioning, that was a lot less fine.
Making people feel uncomfortable now, Keith. I mean,
that wasn't so good.
You're not affirming what they already think they believe. You know?
Exactly. That's fine. Yeah, and I think there's a lot of that going on today in certain... That's my observation. Yeah. I don't make any pejorative judgments. I mean, people believe what they believe, and I'm sure they do wonderful things as well.
Yeah,
but that's what they saw music as. Whereas I didn't. I got involved a bit in the folk music thing. And,
this is during the context of the 1960s.
60s,
so it's a huge, time of
about 64,
upheaval
65,
and social, political.
Yeah.
So you're in the middle of... Yeah. You know, all this stuff. I mean, obviously in America, we've got the hippie, you know, the peace, you know, the summer of love. And all this stuff's going on. So you're right in the middle of all this.
Yeah. But then I moved, you see, from the Brethren, I moved to an Anglican church. Well, that was almost seen as, apparently I was on the prayer list for many years.
Oh, yeah. Pounds straight for hell.
Yes, that's it. I was on the slippery slope.
Oh, yeah.
And, but then, but that was still within a sort of a Christian context. I wouldn't say it was wasn't fundamentalist particularly. Still fairly evangelical, you know, kind of idea. And air quotes, yeah. But wasn't. But again, that eventually began to. I used the phrase "run out of road" for me, and I thought, well, I'm not quite sure where this is going, and I started to very more strongly question my beliefs and as to what path I might take.
All right, we are going to end it there in our discussion today with Keith Rycroft. You know, to me, it's a fascinating discussion, and I liked what Keith said, and he's talking about his own personal journey. What happens when what you're involved in begins to run out of road, and you got really nowhere else to go? Do you have the freedom and the flexibility to continue to explore and grow, and as our friend Richard Rohr says, transition into the second half of your life? And what is all that about? Well, if you want to find out the rest of Keith's story, how he ended up in the Quaker movement and how he became a non-theistic Quaker, make sure and tune in next Friday for part two of my conversation with Keith Rycroft, the non-theistic Quaker from Chester, England. Once again, thank you for listening in to this episode of British Accents on the Preacher's Forum podcast. I'm Dr. Clint Haycock. You can get a hold of me a couple of different ways. Just to remind you one last time, please follow me on Twitter at Preacher's Forum or Preacher's Forum on Instagram. You can get a hold of me that way. You can check out my Facebook page, facebook.com/The Preacher's Forum. You can always email me, preachersforum@gmail.com, and stop by the website, www.preachersforum.com, where you'll find a lot more resources and articles that I've written on a whole variety of topics. So once again, this is Dr. Clint Haycock. Thank you for joining me for this episode of British Accents on the Preacher's Forum podcast. Please be sure and tune in next Friday for part two of my conversation with Keith Rycroft.